the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
God bless America.
All right, we'll call the meeting to order. Trustee Harris?
Here.
Trustee Genrich?
Present.
Trustee Rafter?
Here.
Trustee Vandenhoven is here. Trustee Dart?
Here.
Trustee Gass?
Here.
Trustee Dennis?
Here.
Very nice. Are there any modifications to the agenda this evening? Is there anyone visiting who'd like to see an agenda item moved up or down, but not off the agenda? Okay. Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the agenda as submitted? Trustee Genrich, is there a second? Trustee Dennis? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Announcements.
Chris.
Are you going to hand it over to Chris? Okay.
Thank you. We just have three walks that we want to bring to the board's attention. Two that are on May 2nd, and then one that is scheduled for September 19th. And the two that are on May 2nd, one is on the East River Trail, and one is on the Fox River Trail, so they're not competing.
Are these repeats? And that's okay. So this is
yes.
That's why it's
yep.
in the notification
yep.
or announcement section. Okay. Mr. Byrne?
Two items. Next Monday night from 5 to 7 p.m. here in the boardroom will be the second meeting, the Riverside Drive, for the community design aspect of the project. So that will be a workshop for that citizen team. So that's Monday night. Wednesday night from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, we will have an informational meeting for the residents on the 10 streets for the water main project. So that will be that's an informational meeting. They've all gotten letters from us that describe the project, how it impacts them. And we open up a session for them to come in, do a short presentation on the project, and then it's question and answers from those residents in terms of how this might impact them. There are a few that on the two street or three streets were reconstructed that have some sanitary sewer laterals and so forth. And those will probably be the primary ones that will attend the meeting. But anyway, that's next Wednesday night from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock.
I'll carry in a couple other items. Item B, the Elway Neighbors publication. First edition came out a couple weeks ago.
What a cover.
Excuse me?
What a cover.
some very nice feedback on it, and not because of the picture. But so the next publication will be coming out in the first part of March. So at this point, there's no village funds associated with it. Staff time to provide information. So very, very efficient, and we can always build on it. So that's a good thing. Don't forget February 24th, which is next Tuesday night, is a tour of the Green Bay Met. We're scheduled from 4 to 6. We can certainly meet here, or you can just drive straight out to the Green Bay Met yourself and probably meet at the front office. I'll send out some more directions associated with it.
Off the top of your head, how many people are going to go right there? How many people are going from the board? And are all of you going to go right there, or do you plan on stopping here?
Okay.
Just so that Brad's not waiting around for...
I'll go there.
Okay, we're all going to go right there. We'll try to meet you there right at 4.
Yeah, I'll be there before.
Okay.
And just a reminder also, this Thursday night is our first public open house for the corridor studies. Trevor's been receiving some very positive feedback from businesses, residents, and developers that are planning on attending. So hopefully we'll get a great turnout, and we'll keep that momentum moving forward.
And the format's an open house, so we'll just sort of have displays and information and people around to answer questions, right?
Correct. Several tables will be set up with very similar to what the DOT did. Several tables set up with the same information on each table.
Okay.
And that way people are free to come and go as they choose.
Okay. Good enough. Are there any other announcements? I have one. It's with a mix of excitement and sorrow that I submit my resignation as president of the Village of Alloy effective 6:30 p.m. on April 21st of this year. If for some reason the Board of Trustees decides that I should end my service before that time, I'll consider the board's recommendation. For personal and professional reasons only, I've accepted an employment opportunity outside of the state of Wisconsin, and I don't think they let you serve as a village president if you don't live in the state. So.
Well, residence requirements.
So per sections 17.01.10 and 17.01.13b of the state of Wisconsin statutes, I'm delivering this resignation to the village board and requesting that the village clerk file the letter of resignation tomorrow. It's been an honor serving you, both as a trustee and the president. I've thoroughly enjoyed living here and serving you. And there's more in the letter, but I'll end there.
What if we decide we're not going to let you go?
Yeah, do we have to vote on that?
Yeah. Yeah, I need to my soap store.
So we have to go online. And there's also some other comments that I wanted to make with regard to it, but I think I'm just going to send those via email to the board. Basically outlining how I think the board, the village is in a really good spot right now, both because of all of you and the staff. And so I'm leaving in comforted, knowing that, and in good conscience, knowing that things are going well here. And so anyway, you can read that later, so that I don't have to struggle through it now. Okay? Any other announcements? Top that.
Can we just go home now?
Public appearances. Is there anyone who'd like to speak this evening? Sir?
Jim O'Rourke, 2379 Oakwood Avenue. I've been attending these meetings for 2 years pretty much continuously, along with the historic preservation meetings and a variety of other village meetings. And I've expressed my concern that the creation of the historic districts does not follow the guidelines set by the National Park Service, the Department of the Interior, and we did not appropriately spend the federal funds that were given to us. Tonight you're going to be voting on repealing and reinstating the historic preservation ordinance. It's under your raising of buildings ordinance, but it's my understanding that you intend to recreate the chapter 424. So at this point, it's appropriate to look at section 424.6b, creation of historic districts, and make sure that everything you're doing is in compliance with federal guidelines. Specifically, the Sunset Park historic district is a fiasco. I've notified the Historic Preservation Committee, and the only thing they haven't done is ask a staff member to investigate whether what I've said is actually correct. So I'm going to ask you to not vote in favor of tonight's raise ordinance, because it includes a reinstatement of a new ordinance for the Historic Preservation Committee, and that somebody from the staff should work with me to talk with the National Park Service to make sure that the state did not tamper with our historic preservation study. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak this evening? We will move on to number five, action regarding the visioning and strategic planning wrap-up. I'm not going to entertain a motion with regard to this right now. We'll hear from our benevolent consultant, Mr. Frohnen.
Thank you very much. Benevolent is a nice word to use for free. I don't think anyone's ever described me as benevolent before. So thanks. For the purposes of my presentation tonight, I wanted to bring us back to where it all began and then walk through some of the things we learned both in our visioning sessions that we held here at the Village Hall in person, then the input we received from 90 residents who completed an online survey, and we'll finish with some overall thoughts I have about the process and what the Village Board and others may consider in moving the project forward. It was fun to be invited. Steve and Village Administrator Brad started talking about your quest to do some work in light of the study that's going to take place or is taking place for the changes that will happen on Riverside Drive back in about late November or early December. And one of the things that fascinates me usually when I do this kind of work is the diversity of thought when it appears that there is no consensus. And yet I think tonight in the slides I will show and the information that you'll receive, you'll notice that although it comes from sometimes a different demographic or sometimes a different part of a socioeconomic background or even age, you'll note that many people feel the same way about the village. So on the one hand, it shows that we're doing a lot of good things. On the other hand, it may show us that we're too limiting so that people who wish to explore coming to the village for a business or a residential purpose may feel like there's really no place for them. And so on the one hand, you have stability. On the other hand, you have stability that may actually keep people from wanting to move forward in their plans within the village. So I will share some slides with you. There are only about 83 of them, so I should finish by 9, so Steve can celebrate his resignation. But there aren't that many. There are only about 20, and I won't read it word for word. I'm trusting that you were elected for more than one reason, and one of those reasons would be because you can read. As a way of background, one of the objectives we had to set out on is to share information with residents about the village's planning process. And I understand that this is in various stages of unfolding, and when we spoke with the groups that joined us, it was a limited plan to approach for planning, but nevertheless it was presented. Our second objective was to engage interested village residents to make sure that they had an opportunity to share their thoughts on both the short and long-term plans that will shape the future. And in order to shape the future, we had to understand what our current state was or the present value that we had within the village, and I'll show you some of that as we move forward this evening. And finally, the study was to provide all of you as elected officials, other interested parties, and the leadership in the village a snapshot of residents' feelings about their experiences living or working in the village. And I speak to it as a snapshot because it isn't comprehensive. It wasn't in-depth where we took a sampling of individuals on every 10th household, for example. These were people who were interested to come by or interested to fill out the survey. So in and of itself, it's somewhat biased for people who want to see a bright future or who have some other concerns they want to express about living or working in the village. The methods we use, January 14th and 21st, we had 2 one-hour visioning sessions that were offered here at the Village Hall. As you know, I was back on Tuesday, January 17th, to work with many of you, although I understood that some of you needed to be absent. And as I referred to already, we added an online survey component, mostly as an afterthought. That was not a thought we had going that we would use going into the initial visioning sessions, but because of the attendance and some of the people who were confused about what that Tuesday evening was for, didn't have a chance to participate, so we gave them an opportunity to participate online. These are the big categories that we asked all of you and we asked the people who participated. In order to get a sense of where people are, we needed to find out, are there things that the village does that really makes the place extraordinary or really makes it special? And so we asked the question: is if they were going to stop doing, if they were going to not, if they were going to continue to do something, what would you hope that the village would continue to do? And we put that in the negative. What do you hope the village will never stop doing or continue doing? Then there's always those things that are a bit of an irritant, and they wish they you would stop doing them right away. So the second green category was, what should the village stop doing as soon as practical? And it doesn't mean immediately, but it means in the planning process, are there things that you should work toward to phase out of the operations of the village or in ordinances? And then, were there any worries about the future of Alloway? And oftentimes that gives us insight into what people are actually looking for in their experiences. And then the fact that Administrator Lang was fairly new, we wanted to ask them, what piece of advice would you give to Brad if you could only give them one piece of advice and or elected officials? I began the visioning sessions by talking about the expectations to have a certain level of experiences offered to people who choose the village of Alloway for their home or for their business. The parameters around which are very specific, that we are limited in our planning by what are the taxes and the resources that are available to help us expand on the expectations and improve the experiences. We also knew that there were a series of rules and ordinances, whether that's from a federal level, a state level, a county level, or the village level. There are parameters. Everything that people may want us to do, we may not be able to do because of the need to follow the rules and ordinances to the best of our ability. And finally, programs and services. Programs and services are also helps establish the expectations and the experiences. And if you had an opportunity to look at what was submitted online, I don't know if Brad has submitted that to everyone yet or if it was to certain people, but I hope you all have a chance to look through there to see where the programs and services that the village offers really come to the fore. They come to the top of the list when it comes to what's important to village residents. It was less about taxes and resources and less about rules and ordinances as it was that in order to create that expectation or meet my expectation or create the experiences I desire in the place that I live or work, it really revolved around the programs and services. In fact, I think one person even mentioned that they'd be willing to pay higher taxes in order to continue the experiences, the programs, and services that were here.
Do we have that person's name, my chance?
Steve Vandenhoff. I'll start with what we heard from village residents' thoughts and their insights. Much of it came from the survey, so there'll be some survey data here. It's not all of the data, but by and large, the 90 people who participated online were a lot higher in number than the approximately 15 people who participated in the in-person sessions, not including all of you as trustees. We asked the question, how would you rate your overall experience living in Alloway? You can see most of the people in the 55 to 65% said excellent or very good. A few said okay or average, and that one little gray line by below average was only one person out of the 90 that participated in the survey. We did not ask this question the same way when we were doing the in-person listening sessions or visiting sessions. We provided a list of things that people in the in-person listening sessions and visioning sessions talked about, and we asked the village residents who participated online to indicate all of the things that they liked about living in Alloway. And you can see them here. They're not in any particular order other than the way they appeared on the survey. I'll point out... What was that?
Board of Trustees. That
must be a misprint.
No, that's not a misprint. I was actually going to highlight that for all of you to show you that as good as your work is, you don't come to the top of people's minds and they're thinking about what they enjoy about living in the village. But what they really do enjoy is the location. And almost 90% of the people thought we had a perfect location. I want you to keep that in mind as we look to a few slides at what the scope is of the potential or the vision of the scope for the future of Alloway, because location will have a lot to do with it. You also notice then that safety is about the fifth one down. Safe community is right behind there, just a little bit over 88%. And then some of the other services like parks and trails are not that far behind. There was also an open-ended question, and individuals could write down what they thought beyond these things that they like living about in Alloway. And I will say that there were just a couple I'll highlight. One of them is the ease of contacting appropriate village hall departments. I think that speaks to a responsive government. The other is they appreciated having responsible pet owners living nearby. And one person even was so bold as to say, our new administrator. Now, this was not a confidential survey because when they were here in person, they had to say who they were. So all these responses you'll be able to see based on the number who wrote it. And I believe that was Dylan Lane. So there's a lot to like about living in Alloway. The things that really came to the forefront again on what the village should continue to do, keep doing things that make this a safe community. You saw that in the survey, that was something that people really favored. They liked the family orientation. It will be fascinating to see how the family orientation is described and what that really means when we have a chance over the next year or so, to dig down into what kinds of programs and services are responsive to a family orientation. Parks and Recreation, you'll see in a little bit how that's both bolstered by the survey and the respondents, and also there's some concerns about the Parks and Recreation programs. Keep the village clean and great services, including the leaf and the brush and the snow. And somebody even put, I like that you picked up big junk. They're disappearing, but not on purpose. They're coming back. I don't know why that's doing that, but here are the things that the village should stop doing. Installing things that aren't needed where they're not needed. In this particular case, this person said installing sidewalks where they are unneeded. There's an uneven application of the ordinance. This was described in many different ways using many different terms, but I was able to gel it down into we have many ordinances that either are enforced in part or in full, but they're never consistent. Campers in the backyard year-round was one example. There's also, we heard about the silly green stickers, about when you could put trash on the curb and when you couldn't, about a garage door ordinance that said you had to have all your garage doors closed by 10 o'clock in the evening. So I know that there is some work that's going on right now, but one of the things that distracts people from looking at what's all the good things that are happening is when the application of ordinances appears to be inconsistent or unfair. Stop cutting down trees was something that somebody said to stop doing. Lots of roundabouts. And I put this on the end for a reason. There were many comments that people said that everything that's happening in the village is good. Don't stop doing anything. So there's nothing to stop doing, which I think speaks again to the ability of trustees to put forth a vision to build a future and then the staff to help implement that along with the administrator. We asked people what worried them. Even though safety was a strong component, they worried that neighborhoods or some neighborhoods may not be as safe in the future as they are today. They worried about deteriorating road conditions. Someone also referenced the infrastructure under the roads and how that would change the road conditions. A lot about home values, and I'm going to show you that in a few more slides, how that plays out against all the other things that are going well or not so well in the village. So they called it the housing stock, what would happen to it and how would we maintain its vibrancy. A few people, although one person said they paid more taxes, another person had a concern about taxes, and this has probably to do more with people going into retirement and living more on a fixed income than people who aren't yet retired, and how would they be able to afford to stay in their homes. The business climate, both ends of the spectrum. Not enough to don't go too far and get too many big flashy businesses in the community to keep and maintain that small town feel. And near and close to neighborhood safety was the level of crime and what would we do about crime. And finally, as I referenced a little bit earlier, when it was inconsistent application of the ordinances, is that were we going to be able to have the right ordinances to be enforced in order to maintain all the things that be on the top of this list? Advice to the village administrator, I thought this was relevant to conclude. Take risks. Be bold, it essentially is what was being said to the leaders of the village. stay confident. Don't be shaken by what might be going on around you. Do the things that are right for this village and the people who choose to make this their home or the place of their business. Create a significant alloy brand. I thought this was a very interesting comment because brand is not just about a sign or a look. It's about a feel. There's, as many of you know, a brand ecosystem that revolves around a look, but it also revolves around opportunity, how people feel when they're in the village, and how people talk about the village experience when they're someplace else. That all creates a brand, and that was the advice to Brad. Help the village become an extra special place for people to live for the next generation. This was relevant as we know visioning is not just for our time, but for the time to come. A better job regulating the leaf and the brush pickup and the snow removal. You'll see several comments about why is it that the village comes through with a plow and just kind of sweeps the middle of the road off and then comes by later on and does the rest of the road, or why do they put a leaf schedule out that says we'll pick up on a Tuesday and it's not picked up until a Thursday. And so there's some inconsistencies with that. But
Michael, so that's not about regulating, like people are leaving their leaves in the street and you're not...
That wasn't my sense when I recorded the responses that was to do with the ordinance.
So it's more of implementing the actual program rather than enforcing any...
Exactly. And then finally, just to keep up the great work. I want to change gears just a little bit from just some standard comments to some of the things that many of you who participated as trustees in the listening session we had in January. This is combined with what I heard from the online surveys and the in-person participants. And I tried to take everything I heard and put it into one sentence for your scope in terms of what it was that people were looking for. And oftentimes in visioning sessions or planning and strategic planning, a scope is helpful because then you know when you're out of scope or when you're in scope. And this particular scope is fairly broad, which gives a lot of latitude for the leaders who are going to come forward and build that strategic plan. But they wanted to make sure that the plan was not one-dimensional, that it was more comprehensive. Also wanted to make sure that the plan incorporated information that would help the multi-generational folks that live here, and the babies that are yet to be born, and the people who will choose their home in Alloway in the years to come. Also to be very environmentally aware. So there's three major components at the beginning of this. It's to be comprehensive and inclusive. It's to be multi-generational and reflective on who's yet not here, but we'd like to attract here. And to do things in a way that helps help sustain what it is that the village enjoys today. In a European hamlet feel. I didn't know how else to describe that, so I said European hamlet. I think we all have a vision of what that is. It's kind of small and quaint and comfortable and safe. So we can provide that in a strategic plan, and for the future, we'll do very well. And then particularly when we do this in a way that provides everyone who's here, whether it's residents or businesses and visitors, we did not want to omit visitors because we wanted to be, as part of a brand, to be a destination, with exception that we would create exceptional experiences and opportunities. The experiences, those exceptional experiences, are what we're able to do with what we have today. The opportunities are the things that we hope we can do with what we have tomorrow. So they balance each other well, but we can't get caught up in a visioning session on either just what the experiences are today or the opportunities for tomorrow. They have to be blended, and that's why the scope of this includes both of those parameters. And then finally, I included a statement that somebody made during the session, is that we want to make sure that when people come to Alloway, they know they've arrived, and when they leave, we want them to remember that they left. So that speaks to not only what do they see here, but what can they do here, and what kind of memories are created while they're in the village of Alloway. And it's Randy, it's the memories that you can talk about in public. So the areas of focus then on this day were neighborhoods, recreation, business, safety, and operations. And the next few slides that I'll show to wrap up the presentation will show you the areas that were exciting to you and members of the community who participated, and those in these areas of focus where there was still some concern. So neighborhoods. everyone basically said we really have well-kept neighborhoods. Yes, we have a few things that we can do to keep them a little bit nicer. Yes, there are still campers in people's backyards. Yes, a few people put garbage out when they're not supposed to. But all in all, they were very well-kept neighborhoods was the sentiment in this. One of the things that came up a lot was that this is a historical place, and that's why it's highlighted here in the darker color. That of all the people that talked about neighborhoods, the historical value of what we have here was important to those participating, along with the fact that we have neighbors who take care of neighbors. And this would be evident when you think about whether we're Republican or Democrat, rich or poor, blue collar, white collar. Most people in Alloways will say, if I need something, my neighbor will help me with it. And I think that's very true. And our vision and our strategic plan should reflect that. Neighborhood identity, there are again, more work to be done in these areas, but by and large, we would consider ourselves a neighborhood community, even though we don't necessarily know if we live in one neighborhood or the other. We basically know when we pull down our street what we can expect. Friendly people. And then there are some worries that some neighbors are still disconnected. There are still some people who move into the village who may not know where to go for their services, know where to get connected to the help that they need. And we have to be careful not to make these people feel continue to be disconnected, because while it's not true all of the time, some of those times people who are disenfranchised will also be the people who may cause some of the neighborhoods to feel unsafe or to do things that will change the dynamic of the village. Not necessarily bad if we can learn from it, but we want to make sure that people feel connected. There was a couple of comments that I reflected in this statement, that there's a lack of connection or lack of continuity between what's happening on the north side of Alloway and the south side of Alloway. The only real similarity is that we have a grocery store on both sides of the village, and we can do more than to make the people on the north side feel like they're connected to the south and vice versa. And the biggest worry about neighborhoods is that the housing stock or the value are not going to be kept up. And what do we do to have programs that are in place to help people who can no longer take care of their yards or to paint or to put new shutters on? How do we partner with Rebuilding Together and Habitat for Humanity and others to make sure that our village maintains a housing stock that has extraordinary value? And is the village getting tired? There is a person who reflected on that, meaning just are we falling down because we're older and we don't have the stamina to maintain some of the things we used to be able to maintain. In the areas of recreation, the excitement, the advantage, and the strengths for the parks and the Miracle League Field. And I apologize for the headings. I'm not sure why they did that. They didn't do that at home. Oh, never mind. I was going to say something that I shouldn't. I filtered right there. Playgrounds were an advantage. The trails, number one, excitement as advantage of the areas, the trails that we have, we should make more of them to be that place of destination. We have better facilities than most communities. One person even reflected on the fact that we have lights lighting up some of the parks at night. And youth sports. And the same thing in athletic fields. Where the worries are is we lack entertainment venues. And this was more probably for the younger demographic than the older demographic. But what can people do here after hours, after work hours, or on the weekends? I thought this was very interesting. It's why I paralleled them here. Trails and access to waterway. You'd think that they would be one and the same, but at the same time that trails are seen as an advantage, the access to the waterways is seen as a weakness or a worry or an opportunity to get better. Program diversification for all ages, as I mentioned, very related to the lack of entertainment venues. And that last one was there was not a lot of recreation opportunities like health clubs other than the Y. Under business, we have very community-oriented businesses. Many small businesses make a difference in this community. We have an active business association, someone pointed out. The general location of Alloway makes establishing business here attractive. Locally owned businesses are important as opposed to franchises where owners are absent. And the TIF district was seen as a business advantage. Several of you highlighted that in your comments. And there are the successful businesses on both ends of the village. You feel like you're coming into a vibrant place even before you actually arrive. on the worries or the weaknesses, negative perception of the business climate. How welcoming are we to new businesses, and what can we be doing to make it an attractive place to establish a new business or to have somebody who might be in downtown Green Bay right now, for example, come here with another location. Not taking advantage of the riverfront from a business perspective was seen as one of the greatest weaknesses. Are we competitive enough with other communities? Are we losing out to places around us and not making our environment attractive to business? And the traffic flow was a weakness, both by foot or by bike or by car. Again, that relates right back to the trails and some of the things that we have. How do we maximize the things that we already have? And then the last thing that was of equal concern, not taking advantage of the riverfront, was attracting the right kind of business, and it's too early to determine what the right kind of business is. The study didn't show that, but it was listed as a high area of worry, so I put it in. Finally, in safety, just a few others. Responsive police, great. Safe neighborhoods, we talked about. Low crime rate, very advantageous. The worry or the weakness is that if we stop making our streets walkable, will people who do walk feel safe? We have enough crossings and sidewalk width, particularly sidewalks along Webster Avenue, where you feel like you're almost walking in the lane of traffic rather than in a safe pedestrian area. The housing stock, how does value of the housing lead or not lead to a safe environment? And as the society evolves, we have less neighborhood interaction, so how are we going to improve in that area? And in the final section, operations, we have efficient government, we have a very enthusiastic and committed staff, fiscally responsible, and you trustees who do that with a budget to be applauded for that. And then operational side, love the recycling, leaf and brush pickup, snow removal. Those are highly desirable features of operations. A worry is that there's not enough involvement from residents. We saw that in the listening sessions. I mean, I was delighted, as I said earlier, to have 90 people participate in the online survey, but just less than two dozen participate on over 4 hours was, I don't think, what anybody anticipated. A worry could be that what kind of budget and financial allocations will we need to maintain the services, which goes back to the village perhaps feeling a little bit tired in places. And then what kind of communication will we be able to establish with residents on a regular basis so they show up more for them than just sidewalks and sex offenders. So some general observations. When we think about moving forward, that generally all the good things that the village does are and people have identified with is the things that benefit a larger group of residents. Residents with a T, not a CE. Generally, the things that residents wish that the village would stop doing impact a smaller number of people. And you'll see that in the survey respondents. People drive too fast on my street, or they cut down a tree in my yard, whatever it happens to be. So I put that in perspective that the focus really ought to be the things that are going well, not the few things that impact just a small number of people. Not that they're not important, but we may have to make priorities. We desire to be a destination with neighborhoods that are attractive and that have diverse business offerings for all generations. We have a constituency that tends to trust the village leadership, which is a great starting point. There's more concern about safety and housing values and upkeep than they tend to worry about taxes. As I mentioned earlier, there's the line about sidewalks and sex offenders. You'll see that in your document if you haven't already. And then the last statement was that there's a loss of the loss of a small town feel is not a desirable trade-off just to attract businesses. So the focus I get from this is that it has to be a balance between a vibrant economic program but also keeping that small town feel or that European hamlet type feel. So with that, I will ask if there's any questions, comments, observations, outrage, denunciations.
In your experience, is it common for folks when they're giving feedback on things like this to be more general when they're talking about the things they like and more specific when they're talking about things they dislike? Or is that a phenomenon that you just is pretty unique to this?
I don't remember the psychological term for it, but I know that when you take an experience over a long period of time, people will tend to remember globally the good things as though they happened all of the time. And things that are more negative, that they'll stick out in their head when it's very unique and specific to them. So that it is a trend, and you might remember the psychological term being a student of that area, but I don't.
Okay. Thank you. Trustee Raptor.
I just want to thank Mr. Frona for all the great work you've done and for leading these sessions. It's a great example of how village residents who see an opportunity to help can step forward and add tremendous value to the future, and I thank you very much.
It's my job, Trustee Rutherford. I'm not gone yet.
I take it back, Mike.
Well, one time I did this for another group, and this lady, sweet old lady, she followed me outside, and she said, "Has anyone ever told you what a wonderful job you do at this?" And I got all embarrassed, and I said, "Well, not really." And then she looked at me, and she said, "Then why do you keep on doing that?" Trustee Harris?
May we get a copy of the presentation? I want to be able to write some notes and refer to a few things as we continue.
Yes, that would be fine. The copies, I emailed the slides this evening to Brad, and he has those. And
perfect. We can post them online, too, right? Is that
sure, if I can make the copies of them, and we didn't for tonight, so that you'd be looking at the slide and there and not looking ahead.
Do you think the trend, you know, we had 15 people show up and 90 respond online, and that certainly seems to be the trend in a lot of things. If so, does that underscore our efforts to try to do more communication online and or media-wise than, you know, trying to get people to come into a meeting? I mean, it seems to say, there's another example of that.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. And I think there are, nowadays, with different survey tools, it's very easy to create and get some instant feedback, even if it's just a 3 or 4 question survey you're interested in getting some input on for a particular topic.
And that went out mainly to people on our mailing list, our email list, right? So people who are kind of already engaged or interested somewhat in the village, right? Anything further? On behalf of the board, except for Trustee Rafter, because he already said it, we really thank you for all the time and effort that you put into this. And it is a prime example of how we've got some really talented folks in Alloway. You know, you had mentioned the part about the housing stock and the habitat, and we've been talking about that for years, and Brad and I more intensely during the past 6 months about, you know, if we can find a way to fund it. We've got so much talent in this village and people willing to help out their village, and you're a prime example of that. So we thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Does anyone else need the projector? Can I turn it off? I'll leave it on.
You may turn it off. I don't know if you can. We'll see. If All right, moving on. Item 6, action regarding the adoption of Ordinance 2000. We don't need an action item at all with regard to the visioning, Mr. Lang. It's under a business section, so we can make a motion to accept the presentation and place it on file.
That would be an appropriate motion to take, and I'll be bringing some stuff back in the near future.
With regard to the strategic plan that's
correct. Being presented.
Is there a motion to accept the presentation from Mr. Frohn and place on file? Trustee Dart?
So moved.
Trustee Rafter? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Item number 6, action regarding the adoption of Ordinance 2015-02, raising of buildings. This was postponed from the last meeting. Unless there are objections, I will suspend the rules and not entertain a motion right now, but yet hear the presentation by Mr. Fuller. Mr. Fuller.
Requested at the last meeting that I give kind of a historic preservation 101. And I thought it best appropriate to first describe what a certified local government is, because the village is a certified local government. And with that designation comes a lot of restrictions that kind of trickle down to the discussion later. So village became a certified local government back in 2011. Basically, what the program is it's a federally funded program jointly administered by the National Park Service and the State Historic Preservation Office, which in our case is Wisconsin Historical Society. As you can see, there's two communities that hold this distinction in Brown County, us and De Pere. The slogan of certified local government program is preservation through partnership. And basically what that means is federal, state, and local governments join together to preserve irreplaceable characters of places. That's by definition of the National Park Service. Each community is eligible for different programs and benefits with this distinction under the stipulations that they follow certain requirements laid forth by the federal and state government. Benefits include funding, which I'll describe in the next slide, technical assistance, Wisconsin Historical Society. Part of the requirements of being the State Historic Preservation Office, they have to have a certain level of qualified staff, including professional historian, professional architecture historian, and a professional archaeologist on staff. So we're very fortunate to have available access to that. Also with the technical assistance, we had a presentation in December that the Historic Preservation Committee kind of put on, but it had to do with the benefits of listing your home on the National Register, and for that we had someone from Wisconsin Historical Society come up from Madison to do that presentation for us, so that was very nice. And then another benefit of being a certified local government is the sustainability aspect. Studies show that historic districts maintain their property values, their population densities, they're more walkable, and they have a greater sense of community. So this is a little out of order than what I provided in your packet, but certain eligible grants that Alloway is available for because we are a certified local government. And this kind of goes in ranking order as well when we apply for these grants. Architectural, archaeological, and historical survey projects, we had that done back in 2011 or 2012, I believe. Roughly $20,000 project was completely paid for with a grant from this. Preparation of nominations to the National Register of Historic Places. We recently received another grant to do this for two of our municipal buildings, the Community Center on Webster and the pump station on Green Avenue, and those are in the process. They should be voted on in May. That's about a $6,500 project. Educational activities, sort of along the lines of what I just mentioned with the staff from Wisconsin Historical Society, as well as we just actually received an email this afternoon about opportunity, because we're a sort of certified local government, to have our commission members go down to Atlanta and learn about the Main Street program. So as a scholarship opportunity offered only to CLGs. Development of municipal preservation plans, I'll kind of discuss that a little bit later. Administration of municipal historic preservation programs, that doesn't really apply to us. So with these benefits, like I said, come requirements. The National Park Service, or the federal requirements, is established by ordinance Historic Preservation Committee. The next one is enforce state or local legislation by the designation and protection of historic properties. Sorry for reading these, but these are these will all be covered later on in the presentation. Maintaining a system for the survey and inventory of local historic resources. So we did that with the intensive survey. Provide for public participation in the local historic preservation program. And again, that will be covered later. Feel free to stop me and ask questions as we're going along. So the state requirements: enact and enforce an ordinance that regulates historic property, provide an annual report, and that's just a brief, it's straightforward two-page report that we do every year. Send a copy of meeting minutes to Wisconsin Historical Society. Cannot allow property owners to opt out of local designation. And this one, it seems worse than it is, but in all honesty, and from what I've heard from a lot of people I've spoken with, from a practical standpoint, a community really wouldn't approach and force a designation on the property owner if they didn't want to, because it's bad PR. Yes, we are capable of it. We have the ability, but whether or not we actually act on it is another thing. Cannot require owner consent for local designation. That kind of goes along with the other one. Proof work on locally designated properties cannot be advisory. So now we're moving on to the National Register. Any questions so far in the certified local government?
Can you go back one slide in terms of cannot be advisory? What are you?
It means I'll get to this in the landmarks and historic preservation ordinance. But basically, if the historic preservation committee reviews some alterations or raisings, or really just alterations to a building, those cannot just be advisory. They're regulatory. I'll show you later on in the ordinance how that can be appealed, though.
And when you're talking about the CLG, does the statute or do the federal regulations specifically state what that has to look like? Does it have to be the Historic Preservation Committee or Commission, or can it be the Village Board? And where does it dictate where that? Or it can't be advisory, right? What are we talking about? When we talk about it can't be advisory. What is it?
How it reads is the Historic Preservation Committee or Commission cannot be advisory.
Okay.
Or has to be advisory. Or okay. Cannot be advisory.
Cannot be advisory, yeah.
Confusing.
Okay, so we're talking about not only that the municipality, when we're talking about the CLG, we're really talking about the Historic Preservation Commission or Committee. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So all of these attributes, you're talking about that committee, not about the village board. So you couldn't say that the committee is advisory, but the board is not advisory. The board makes the decision. Okay. That's not
correct.
That would not align with the rules.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So the National Register of Historic Places is the nation's official list of historic places. It identifies sites, districts, structures, and objects that are worth preserving. There's criteria listed, and this is taken from the National Park Service. I won't read through it, but what I wanted to point out about this is the same criteria that's listed here is actually found in our ordinance under section 424-4A. It's pretty much word for word, slight change in wording, but. So the same criteria that the National Park Service uses, we also use we would also use because we only have one local designation, but in doing local designations. So the nomination process, more often than not, is initiated by a local property owner or by a local municipality. then from there, it goes to the State Historic Preservation Review Board, which is separate from the Wisconsin Historical Society. And they review and consider each property and recommend it to the National Park Service. And that happens 4 times a year. And then from there, the National Park Service makes the final decision on whether or not to list it on the National Register. And I included a picture of the pump station and the community center because those are both currently up for nomination. So there's a lot of benefits for listing your home on the National Register. Of course, it's very prestigious and has great honor attached to it. But also there's consideration and planning for federally funded or federally assisted projects. This applies to us. Section 106 is how it's typically referred to in the Riverside Drive Reconstruction Project. The proposed historic district in Sunset Park area and in the Robinson Hill District area both have, I guess the DOT will look at them more closely when going at projects. Eligibility for federal grants. This doesn't come around too often, but there are grants out there that homeowners could apply for. Eligibility for a plaque and or signs. It's important to note that you're just eligible. They don't give them to you. You still have to buy them. So, eligibility for certain tax credits, which I'll mention in the next slide. But the main misconception of the National Register that I want to point out is the loss of property rights. Because your home's listed on the National Register does not mean that you cannot raise your house or you cannot change different things to it. The only time the National Park Service or the Wisconsin Historical Society really have concern as far as what you're doing to your property is if you're seeking those tax credits. So if you want to, if you add a home on a National Register and you want to forego those tax credits and put on a new age roof or something, that'd totally be acceptable. It is important to note that when raising a house or a structure or anything of that nature, it's listed on the National Register, there is that 30-day review period, and that's primarily so that pictures can be taken and the property can be documented. But really, they do not regulate whether or not you can raise your building or not. So the tax credits. Eligible property owners can receive dollar-for-dollar reduction of state income taxes up to 25% of the project, and this can be carried over for 15 years. So if I had a $20,000 project, I could receive $5,000 to my state income tax, and I don't know what... If you could spread that out, I guess, over 15 years, if you so choose to. Eligible projects include exterior alterations, interior of a window sash, if the exterior sash is done, structural elements, heating and ventilating systems, and electrical or plumbing systems only, so the fixtures are not included in that. So now we're moving on to the Landmarks and Historic Preservation Ordinance. Any questions on the National Register information? No? So the ordinance is something that, as I mentioned, is required by being a certified local government. The authorities granted by this ordinance are the are part of the regulations that are bestowed upon us or expected of us to pass to hold that designation. So it establishes the Historic Preservation Committee, ability to designate properties as local landmarks, ability to review alteration or raising requests, and educates the community about historic preservation. So now we're going to go through the processes, and you can really follow this word for word, or not word for word, but you can step by step in our ordinance as well. So the first process is designation of sites or structures. So how this would come about is the Historic Preservation Committee would recommend a historic structure or site. From there, the clerk would notice property owners of that site or structure and those with surrounding 200 feet. And that would be within 10 days of the public hearing. And the village board would hold the public hearing. Within 30 days of that public hearing, the village board is required to make a decision. Then the village would notify the property owner and register deeds. And then if the village so chose, they could buy a plaque for that site or structure, or the property owner could take on that cost as well. The designation of historic districts is a little more in-depth. The Historic Preservation Committee will select a geographic location. And then, as I mentioned earlier about the preservation plan, they have to have a preservation plan set for that district. So that's pretty involved. That's something that we typically hire out consultants for. And that's typically when people think of the National Register and they think of the regulations that come along with it, that's really not the National Register. That's usually in the local municipality's preservation plans. So that's where that discrepancy comes from. So after the Historic Preservation Committee did those two things, they would then notice the property owners and those within 200 feet, and within 10 days have a public hearing. Then they would recommend the historic district and the preservation plan. From there, do another notice within 10 days. The village board holds a public hearing. Within 30 days, the village board would make the decision. I'm sorry, there is actually no timeline spelled out in the ordinance for that part. And then from there, you get out of the plaque and or signs, like the Brown Street signs that you guys see in Esther Park. The next thing that comes along with this is the certificate of appropriateness. And this would come about for properties that are locally designated and wish to make any alterations, reconstruction, or addition to the property. They would have to file a petition with the committee. The committee reviews it. And they approve or deny it within 30 days. And then this is regulatory. But the petitioner can appeal the decision to the village board. And the village board may reverse the decision if they so chose. Then we move on to the certificate of appropriateness for raising. And this is really everything else I described so far is already in place. We already have something in place for the certificate of raising, but this is the main part that's really changing in the ordinance.
Trevor, can you back up for 1 second?
Sure.
The last one. So in this area, is this where you say they could put a modern roof on if they wanted? They just wouldn't get the tax credits? Or is this saying they can't do anything to their building?
If it was locally designated, they could not. Not without permission of the preservation committee. And then, I guess, if they did not make that decision, they could always appeal it with the village board.
So this is like a permit to make alterations to your locally designated property that are prohibited under our ordinance.
Correct. So then the certificate for raising the petitioner...
Excuse me, Trevor.
Oh, go ahead.
Back up one more time.
Oh, sure.
Well, you don't have to really back up, but I just want to be clear. So these other things that we just read through, those are all already in our ordinance. We're not putting anything new in place.
Correct.
That's there already.
Correct.
Okay.
And this raising section is there already. We're just extending the timeline. So the committee would receive the certificate of appropriateness. They would review it. And then I have here in black the current timeline. So within 30 days, the committee would approve or deny the certificate. And then in red is the proposed amendment. 60 days for residential buildings, 90 days for non-residential. And then, of course, the petitioner can file an appeal with the village board. And the village board could reverse that. Or, if after 120 days, if nothing was really done to... they could preserve the building. The building inspector could issue the building permit, and that's actually an addition as well. I know, Trustee Harris, you asked that last time. That's something that was we found on Wisconsin Historical Society's website for recommended.
So if nothing happens, no one makes a decision after 120 days. The building inspector could just issue the permit.
That's great. Yeah. And
4 months seems like enough to me.
Right.
And so basically all we do is buy a cooling off period for people to talk and the committee to try and exert some influence. But the property owner just wants to buy his time and wait 120 days and get his raise order and knock it down anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And all this is, you know, within 30 days or within the time limit. So if the committee didn't want to, you know, regulate this or didn't wish to spend the whole 30 days because it wasn't necessarily a building they wished to do that for, they could, you know, suspend that or waive that time
sure.
as well. So. So I gave to you some comments that Roger Retzloff, he's a Planning Commission member, he sent me this afternoon. And basically, he's in points for having an ordinance like this. In addition to that, I invited Barb Cockrood here. She's been working on this ordinance since we began it back in April. And she's on the Historic Preservation Committee and also the chair, as you guys know, for the Planning Commission. So if you have no other questions for me, Barb, do you have anything to add?
We did go through the process of locally designating the...
I'm sorry, Barb, could you... Thank you.
3725 Delano Street. We did go through the process a couple of years ago to locally designate the guardhouse at Heritage Hill. That was locally designated. It went through the process. It came to the board. And then they wanted to make some repairs to that guardhouse. So then we did issue the certificate of appropriateness. That was the first and only building that we have locally designated at this point. But that was one that was very easy to work through the process. They gave us a lot of documentation. They had to jump through a lot of hoops at the state level before that ever came to us.
Okay. Thank you. So I think the issue last time was whether or not the Historic Preservation Committee has the authority to basically regulate property rights. And it strikes me that in one sense you do have plenty of authority and power because it's required, right, by the statutes or the federal rules. On the other hand, the property owner always has the right to petition and for anything to come through the village board. Am I understanding that correctly? So if a property owner wants to do one thing and the Historic Preservation Committee wants to do something different, that's not the end game ever, right? It's the property owner can always take it to a different level.
Right.
So the Historic Preservation Committee would have to make a decision on it, and the board would have to make a decision on it in order to not do what the property owner wants.
Right.
Correct? Okay. And then, as you said at the introduction of your comments, very few communities do this because, right, who wants to annoy their residents enough by having two committees of the village, one the Historic Preservation Commissioner Committee and the village board, in this case, not do what a resident wants?
That's correct. And I also talked to Joe DeRose. He's a representative from Wisconsin Historical Society, and asked him specifically on this issue, and he said what he's seen in the past is sometimes a committee will feel like a specific property is really important, and they will go against the property owner's wishes. And what it typically does is, as you can imagine, is it stirs a lot of commotion in the community. He said a lot of times you'll have a small party for it, small party against it, and then a good amount of the population is really just caught up in the chaos. And what it does is it ends up painting a negative light on the committee. And he said it really takes about 10 years in his experience to gain back that reputation. So really it wouldn't be in the best interest of the committee to act on their authority.
Right. Especially if the board ends up overruling them. Right. But I would imagine most boards are like that as well. We have enough contentious issues to deal with, you know, whether or not someone can make improvements to their home or tear down their home. I mean, that should definitely be left to the property owner. But I can understand why, you know, why you have to do what you do. It seems to be in the regulations that you have to have that authority. You cannot be advisory. But I like the idea that there's always an appeal process for the homeowner to come to the village board. So you get a group of, you know, five plus people on the Historic Preservation Committee that have to, and then you've got a village board of seven that have to agree with them before they can counteract the property owner's wishes. Trustee Guest.
No, I mean, I like the procedure. I mean, because I think it gives at least an extended period of time for the committee to exercise influence. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be necessarily in favor of dictating what property owners can and can't do, but at least it gives a period of time where there can be dialogue and input given. And I remember sitting here, and you do too, remember when they raised the Chancery Building?
Yeah.
And we had lots of people in here complaining, you know, and wanted us to do something about it. And we didn't even have this kind of a raise ordinance in effect. There wasn't anything we could do.
And the 30 days wouldn't have been enough. I liked that, increasing that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have been enough. We just had to sort of get oriented to the topic, and before we could, the building was...
Yeah, we had very little opportunity for input or community dialogue or committee dialogue or input into that process. So I like the raise ordinance. I mean, it gives time for dialogue. You know, and maybe decisions can be altered and historic preservation maintained. So I think it's a good ordinance. And it works hand in hand with the committee structure, and I'm in favor of it.
That was my question. It was the same topic. Would it have extended that period of time in the raising of the chancery? But other than that, it wouldn't have affected the owner, in that case, his decision to proceed with it.
And you're right, John. I mean, this just gives us an opportunity for input and dialogue and to get the community, you know, involved in the process. Otherwise, it can happen pretty much in the dead of night. And you wake up one morning, it's just gone. But ultimately, the decision, at least as I read these things, they do rest with the owner ultimately after this, you know, review period.
The board.
No, they don't.
On the radar.
I mean, it might have worked out differently if this were locally designated, right? The chancery, the bishop's residence, and the committee said, no, you can't tear it down. And the diocese would have said, we want to tear it down, and they appealed to the board. The board could have said, no, you can't tear it down.
If you guys didn't have anything in place to preserve it.
All right, I mean, back then we had nothing, so there's nothing we could have done. But if we had everything in place that we're putting in place now, it's if your committee agrees to it,
and the Board of Trustees supports your decision, then the property owner cannot tear down that building, right?
During that period, what we would be looking for is somebody that would maybe be willing to purchase the building and relocate it, or looking for grants to help them make the improvements that they feel that they can't afford. So it isn't that dialogue is really important to try to do something to help them.
But they all, I mean, if you decide even within, you know, right away that they can't do it and they appeal to the board says no, you can't tear it down, and that's it, right? They can't tear it down. But then can they petition again? Can they apply again?
I think they could, sure. If they have additional information.
So is that not your understanding of what Trevor just said, Trustee Gass? I mean, that was, to me, was the whole issue about property rights. And at the end of the day, if the Historic Preservation Committee says you can't tear it down and the board says you can't tear it down, then the person can't tear down their own property.
They could.
They still could?
If it went through that 120-day period. And yes. we had nothing in place to show that we were trying to preserve it, trying to move the building, trying to do anything of that nature.
Oh, okay. I thought we just had 120 days to make a decision.
No.
Okay.
No, the way I read this is after that 120 days expires, the building inspector can issue a raise permit.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Even if the Historic Preservation Committee and the board said no.
Right.
So what has to happen in that 120 days in order for the building inspector to not be able to issue the permit?
The committee has to show that it's taking the proper steps in either securing funding or something along those lines that could preserve that building, if not on site, if they maybe move it to a different location as well.
So you have to find a buyer or somewhere to move it or some way to make the improvements to the satisfaction of the homeowner, or they can do what they want. It's their property after 120 days.
That's correct.
Oh, gosh.
So using the chancery as an example, if during those 120 days, if this was in force at that time, and you were able to find grants to help them pay for all the asbestos removal and everything else that was in there, would they then not be able to raise the building? If you could show that you found funds to make the remediations required?
Sure.
I wouldn't be able to answer, but it almost is. I don't know. That's a good question.
And the reason. And
that's the heart of the issue is what has to happen in that 120 days in order for the property owner not to have the right to raise his or her own building? Or is there anything?
Well, basically what it says is the building permit or the building inspector will issue the permit after the 120 days if no mutually agreeable method of saving the property is underway.
So it's just a cooling off. It's
mutual agreement.
Mutual is a key word. Yeah.
Or if no formal application for funds from any governmental or nonprofit to preserve is pending. So I suspect with the chancery fraud, if there was a significant fundraising effort underway to actually be able to pick that house up and move it to someplace else, then we could refuse to issue the raise order.
We could stop.
But if at the end of 120 days there's no mutual agreement between all parties to do something, which includes the owner, or if there's not, you know, significant funding on the way to save the structure, then they can raise it.
And that's only if previous to this, the chancery building was locally designated.
Yeah, we had nothing at all, right?
Right.
Oh, okay. So if it was already locally designated, we couldn't designate something when we would want to.
Okay.
So right now we have one building we have to worry about.
Right, and that's in Heritage Hill, so.
But it still comes down to the building inspector. If, let's say, a homeowner does not want to listen,
yeah,
they can still drag their feet, no, I'm not interested, so on and so forth, and it ultimately is a building inspector decision, instead of the historical committee, instead of the board, the building inspector has the final decision. That's what this is. That's the way I'm reading it. I don't know if that's correct or not.
But it sounds like the building inspector would have no recourse but to do it because the property owner has that right.
Yeah,
it's not like the building inspector has that power.
By default.
They, right.
Yeah, they're just implementing.
Yeah,
the language is kind of vague to me. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it. I understand the mutually agreed. If you work out a deal, great. What if the property owner just doesn't want to, I don't care what you do, I want to tear this building down.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have any mutual agreement, and I don't care if you're raising money. I want to tear this building down. I like the lot. I like the location. I want to tear it down and build a new house right here. So you can raise all the money you want. I'm not selling the house. I'm not selling the lot unless you think you want to pick it up. I guess that's the only reason. You think you can raise money and pick it up and move it somewhere else. That's right? Otherwise, we have... That's the part I don't understand. I mean, what has to happen? How much money has to be raised? How much...
Where do you go for that, right?
What?
And where do you go for that?
Yep.
Is it a big public fundraiser? Or there is the... is it the Brown County Historic Trust?
Yeah, they
have some... option. They could maybe have some options or some places to look for funding for that type of a thing, so we would probably steer them towards that group initially.
Well, I think in the example we were using, there were attempts to do that, but the reality is to raise that kind of funds in that short a time. I'm sure if it were to have happened there or in the future, a property owner might agree, but I think we're saying the property owner and taxpayer still has final decision.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm getting.
He or she are happy with the alternative.
Well, because
I mean, even if they raise enough money to buy them, I don't want to sell it. Right? I mean, I'm just not sure. I can think of a scenario where the property owner would be forced not to tear the building down, except if enough money had been raised to pick up the building and move it.
And I think that this ordinance, which leaves the ultimate decision in the hands of the property owner,
right,
is the only constitutionally permissible one. We can't be the final arbiter of what a person does with their own private property.
Right. Well, that's what we struggled with the chancery to begin with.
Yeah, because we just can't. I mean, otherwise, it's a governmental taking.
Right.
I mean, if we restrict their usage to microscopic degree, I mean, we can't do that. You know, but this buys a cooling off period, and maybe minds can be changed. I mean, you know, with the input of the committee, with the input of the board, and particularly if the community rises up and you know, says no, this gives a period for all of that to happen, and maybe preservation goals can be achieved during that window of time, at least in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. I mean, it happened in the chancery. It just was slower. We didn't really know exactly what we were doing, and there were only a few people kind of interested in preserving it, and they actually tried to raise money to see if they could, you know, make it improve or buy the property, we didn't have these sorts of rules, so it was torn down.
But this is a little open-ended at the end, where it says, unless they've raised enough money or substantial, would we want to say instead, unless they've raised the money required to effect a move or within that 120-day period?
Where's this wording from?
I believe, Barb and I were discussing this. We've been working on this since April, and we looked at a few communities' ordinances as well as what we found on Wisconsin Historical Society's website. I believe this particular section came from WHS's website. Not 100% sure off the top of my head, though.
Mm-hmm. But they did review it, and they are approving what we are proposing.
Right.
Questions right now? Trevor, is there anyone else you'd like to speak with regard to this issue?
Yes, sir.
Uh,
Jim O'Rourke, 2339 Oakwood Avenue. Based upon what the State Historical Society did in Sunset Park, they're not qualified to advise this village or any other municipality in the state of Wisconsin, and they should be reported to the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else like to speak before we take up the rules? Okay, we'll take up the rules. Any further discussion before I entertain a motion? I have a few discussion points. I was bothered by the way that our discussion took place at the last meeting with regard to this issue. I didn't appreciate the way that our visitor, Mr. O'Rourke, treated a very young employee who I think is doing a fabulous job. And I found Mr. O'Rourke's comments to be demeaning and antagonistic. And I ran for village president, I think it was, on a particular campaign. It was very clever, if I say so myself. It was the VA campaign, VA for Van and Oppen, and V for values and A for attitude. And one of the reasons that I joined this board was because I saw uncivil behavior not only between board members, but between board members and residents. And while I continue to believe that residents have a right to their opinion, even if they don't agree with the performance or the opinions of the board or the staff, they do not have the right to express them in any way that they wish. So, unfortunately, I failed to put a stop to the confrontational and demeaning tone towards Mr. Fuller and towards the Historic Preservation Committee that I've witnessed, and for that I apologize. It won't happen again, although I won't be here very long. It won't happen again under my watch. It's my understanding that there are members of the Historic Preservation Committee who have quit or who have voiced a desire to quit as a result of some of this behavior, and again, I apologize for that. I'm assuming that Mr. O'Rourke will be offering a similar public apology. But I was upset, or I should say concerned, not only by the tone of the conversation, but by the content of the conversation. And during our previous meeting related to the RAISE ordinance and the intensive survey to which it's related, and I'll explain that in a minute. Later that evening, I was working late. Actually, it was the next morning. It was about 10 after 12 in the morning. I emailed Mr. O'Rourke and told him that I strongly believe that his comments were a misrepresentation of our discussions, and then he needed to be held accountable for them, and I asked to meet with him to clarify. Mr. O'Rourke declined that invitation a couple of times and seemed to have interpreted this email as a threat against him. I think he called it bizarre and threatening, and reached out to other village board trustees, apparently saying that I was threatening him on their behalf. And so I take exception to that. I still maintain that, like the rest of us, Mr. O'Rourke needs to be held accountable for what he says in public meetings, including accusations that he might make of village staff, of the village board, or of the State Historic Society. So, in particular, I had a problem with the content of his comment that, to make a long story short, I've been talking with Steve for well over a year on this. I've asked him to contact the National Park Service and look into them. I'm not sure who them was. I think it was the State Historic Society. Steve told me that it's not a place to go. And if I have complaints about the meetings and the way the meetings are done, I need to talk to somebody at the county level. And I thought that was really bad advice. There are two issues going on here. There's one as to whether we should be accusing the state Historic Preservation Society of negligent and fraudulent behavior, which I think is Mr. O'Rourke's wish.
when Mr. O'Rourke made the initial request that we accuse the State Historic Society of fraudulence and altering records, I told him that I didn't tell him that the National Park Service was not the place to go and that he should go to the county. In fact, I'm convinced the National Park Service is the place to go. They are the ultimate authority. What I told him then and have repeated multiple times is that if I'm going to accuse our State Historic Society of any sort of illegal or negligent behavior, I want clear and convincing evidence, and I want the exact offense and clear evidence to suggest that the offense took place, and having gotten that. I never advised Mr. O'Rourke, if he had a problem with the State Historic Society, to go to the county. That was a completely different issue. Mr. O'Rourke had accused the Historic Preservation Committee of breaking open meetings laws. And I take those very seriously, and I checked into if one wants to make a formal complaint against a committee of the village, what they should do, and they should go to the county. And so my directions for him were to go to the county for that issue, not with regard to whether our Wisconsin Historical, the State Historical Society has done anything wrong. So there are two completely issues, different issues, but they were sort of melded into one. It was a complete misrepresentation to what I've, the advice that I gave to Mr. O'Rourke. So I wanted to clear that up. But there's a larger issue. This is an example, in my opinion, of what is at the heart of this whole issue with regard to historic preservation. And because we cannot discuss issues outside of an open board meeting, I've had conversations with Mr. O'Rourke privately and have been trying to work on this, as he said, for probably over 2 years now. It has become apparent to me after multiple invitations to try to work this out that's not working. And so I think the board needs to be involved in these discussions. And so I'd like to start these discussions tonight in the hopes that as a board we can come with some resolution to this issue, because my attempts to do so with Mr. Borg have not gotten anywhere. He's obviously very frustrated, and to tell you the truth, so am I. So I'd like to start those discussions tonight related to the intensive survey and the performance of the State Historic Society. It is not an agenda item, but it is very much, as Mr. O'Rourke pointed out, related to the issue at hand, the RAISE ordinance. The RAISE ordinance relies on the intensive survey, and if you look at the ordinance, we are actually repealing and recreating part of it. So it is very much related to the intensive survey. I really want to, again, start the discussion tonight so that by the time I leave office, we're on the same page. We're moving forward as a community. We have been horrifically inefficient in solving this issue. And as I'll discuss later, we spent hundreds of hours on the time of board members, staff members. I don't know how much time Mr. O'Rourke has spent on this, probably quite a bit. My estimation is that we have spent in the neighborhood of $75,000 trying to work out this one issue of the validity of the intensive survey between the time from the village staff, the time from the legacy, our consultants, the time at the from the State Historic Society. So we need to put this thing to rest and chart out a plan. So before I give you any sort of history that I have that you will not know about, I'd like to open it up to the board and then open it up to the public if Mr. O'Rourke wants to speak to get your input on this issue. The main issue at hand is whether the State Historic Society and the consultant legacy were well enough equipped, trained, to do the work that they did, and whether they fraudulently changed, didn't follow the federal rules, and or changed information in the intensive survey, making it an invalid document. And as far as I can understand, especially from Mr. O'Rourke's comments before, that's the main issue. And I think Mr. O'Rourke wants the survey to be redone and wants us to basically appeal to the feds to nullify the existing intensive survey, and I think to put maybe forward some money again so we can redo the survey and do it right. Trustee Gannon.
Well, I think in terms of the raise order and the raise ordinance, and the designation issue, I mean, those are somewhat apples and oranges in my mind. I mean, the raise ordinance that we're going to be acting on in a little bit of time doesn't itself have anything to do with designation. I mean, it honors designations in terms of what you have to do, but this document doesn't do anything about designating any particular structure. So I think, you know, we could pass the raise ordinance and not totally, you know, discredit or discount Mr. O'Rourke's concerns, because this has nothing to do with designation. I mean, if something is improperly designated or is properly designated, this ordinance doesn't have anything to do with that. So I think this ordinance stands alone. In terms of the State Historical Society, my sense is, as an official arm of the state of Wisconsin, I think they have some presumption of validity. I mean, if Mr. O'Rourke has, you know, specific charges, which I haven't seen, and I've heard about them, but I would be willing to look at them. I mean, if there's a bill of particulars, that, in terms of specifics, in terms of they did this wrong and they did that wrong, they violated this law, I mean, it's something I think we listen to. You know, I mean, I'd be willing to listen to it. But it has to be specific in my mind. I mean, I want to see what the evidence is, because I agree with the village president. If I'm going to accuse anybody of fraudulent behavior or illegal conduct, I want to be damn sure I'm right. I want to be 110% sure I'm right. So if the evidence is there, fine. Then we'll take it and we'll run with it. If the evidence isn't there, then we're not going to do anything. But that will depend upon the quality of the evidence and the bill of particulars in terms of what specifically they did wrong, what specifically they did illegally, and if it bears fruit, if it's meritorious, then we'll take it to the next level. I think it would be with the Department of the Interior. National Park Service. I mean, if there is a credible complaint to be made, then we'll make that. If that's incumbent upon us, if we are made privy to substantial and incredible evidence that something bad and wrong happened, I think it's incumbent upon us as elected officials to present that to the next higher authority. But in my mind, I'm going to be damn sure that that happened before I tell anybody it happened, and they should be looked into. So, is that the issue you want to talk about?
Yeah, and I will add, I've had the same conversation, and to my liking, I haven't gotten the evidence, the very clear evidence related to very specific issues that I was looking for. And we must have sent 100 emails back and forth to one another with regard to this issue over the past a couple of years. Most recently, the requests have come in the form of open records requests. And so we've had to enlist the services of the clerk and sometimes the attorney when it looks like the open records requests and this is where it comes back to rhetoric. I've talked to Mr. O'Rourke about this as well, and that some of the words that he chooses to use insinuate that the village itself has done something negligent or fraudulent. And at that point, I call the attorney. It's my responsibility to the village to call the attorney. So Dennis has been involved in a lot of this as well, and has written a letter to the National Park Service outlining the situation and asking for their guidance, and has yet to receive a response. So these have been taken seriously. Mr. O'Rourke's ideas have been taken seriously. Everything from designating Alloway as a historic suburb to Highway 57 being or the Riverside being a scenic byway, and it's not that they haven't been taken seriously. Action has been taken, and we've tried our best to collect evidence that would warrant the kind of action that Mr. O'Rourke is seeking. So I don't want to give you the impression that we haven't been doing anything. I think we have. Mr. O'Rourke might have a different take on it. But the state, the Historic Preservation Office has sort of cut off communication with Mr. O'Rourke. The legacy, the consultant, wrote an email to our attorney asking that Mr. O'Rourke cease and desist in portraying their organization as being neglectful and fraudulent. So a lot has gone on. But there's a lot of history behind this, and hours have been spent on this issue. So I don't want this board to think that, you know, nothing's been done with regard to this issue. It's just you haven't been hearing about it because I haven't been able to tell you. Trustee Gennery.
Has there been any precedent regarding either the Historical Society or the Legacy Group from other municipalities that have been unhappy with their work or their... Because I think we did a what would you call it?
Compared an RFP?
Right, with a couple of different providers. We chose them. There was no history that I'm aware of. And it strikes me as odd that we would be the first to suffer these allegations or whatever.
As far as I know, there haven't been. I mean, we chose Legacy as the initial contractor, and then we chose them again to work on the two buildings, right?
And again, not that, you know, we couldn't be the first, or there were other issues, but it seems we're wading into some awfully treacherous legal ground that could become very problematic.
And I appreciate Mr. O'Rourke's passion. I think he thinks he's right, and I have to respect that. And it's just to the point now where every email that I get, and they're about issues unrelated to the intensive survey now. It's like I said, there was one recently about open meetings for the historic preservation, that they were breaking open meetings laws. Requested all of my emails and the previous administrator's emails related to the intensive survey, and those were collected in, I think it was 6 months. I'm not sure if Mr. O'Rourke picked them up yet, but it was at least 6 months that he hadn't picked them up. So we're doing a lot of work, and we're not getting anywhere. And it's been a source of frustration for me and for the village attorney, and I'm sure for Mr. O'Rourke as well. But Mr. O'Rourke has refused my repeated invitations to meet with him one-on-one, most recently this last couple of weeks, to clear up his comments from the last meeting. So I thought it was time for us to have a larger conversation, since this sort of one-on-one approach really isn't working. Trustee Dark, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, and I don't know if this is, I don't know what I should add here, but originally when the intensive survey was done, what I recall, the difference that because I had a hard time understanding what he perceived as wrong at that point in time. And then we invited, was it a person from the state or from Legacy, to come back and talk publicly about it. And when they went over it, I got the feeling that the state is talking about buildings, and Mr. O'Rourke was talking about places where there were no buildings. And it seemed like it started from that, and the whole intensive survey was related to structure, not no structure. So it wasn't relevant. The areas, Mr. O'Rourke, to the state, wasn't relevant because there was no buildings there. And I think that's where it started. And then I could never really follow it.
And again, my recollection is that we, the attorney and I met with Mr. O'Rourke early on, and I just was not ready to partake in allegations like that because I didn't feel like I had the evidence. But we encouraged Mr. O'Rourke, if he thought he had the evidence and wanted to do so, to contact the National Park Service himself. And I thought that was going to happen. I don't know if it ever did. I was never copied on a letter or an email from Mr. O'Rourke to the National Park Service. But and then eventually, I think it was in September,
that you're shaking your head, Brett, that the Attorney Duffy sent an email on behalf of, or a letter on behalf of the village to the National Park Service asking for their guidance.
And that's the one that we have not gotten a response on.
We haven't gotten a response to that.
Okay.
So it's perfectly apparent that what I'm doing now isn't working. What's not apparent to me is, you know, how we can move forward. And I do know, with whatever this board decides as we move forward between now and when I leave in April or any time thereafter, the words that we choose are going to be important. That's where I think Mr. O'Rourke and I got off on the wrong foot, is that he was using words that, to my previous discussion, seemed antagonistic and confrontational, and more importantly, accusational in a legal sense. And right then, I, like I said before, I've got to make sure I get the attorney, but I owe it to the village not to put the village in a position where I say or do something that's incorrect. And so whenever there are accusations that sound like they're legal accusations, then I got I had to get the attorney involved. I think I've been patient, accommodating, and professional to Mr. O'Rourke, but something has to change, and it has to change soon. I personally have no confidence in that information is going to be presented in a manner like I originally asked for 2 years ago. What was the specific offense? And what is the clear evidence that that offense took place? I haven't received it in this amount of time. I'm not confident that's ever going to come, but that would be up to all of you to decide whether you wanted to go down that path. I wished that it could have gone differently. I've invited Mr. O'Rourke to join the Historic Preservation Committee, and doesn't seem to have interest in joining any formal committees of the village. Yes.
Well, I mean, I think these are serious allegations, and I think the village needs to listen, analyze, make a decision, and move on. I mean, my thought is, I know you've been dealing with it for a long time. I mean, Jim, if you got something, I want to see it by the second meeting in March. I mean, I want to see specifically what you got. We'll listen to you, we'll hear you, and we'll make a decision. I mean, if there's validity, we'll take it to the next level. If there is no validity,
I'm asking you to address the board.
Oh, yeah, I was just laying on protocol.
All right.
You know, let's just grab the bull by the horn. Put it on an agenda, and I'd suggest the second meeting in March. I mean, that gives us all plenty of time, or gives Mr. O'Rourke plenty of time, to get the bill of particulars, the evidence to the board. We'll have an open discussion of it. We'll see if there's any merit to the claims. If there is, we'll make the appropriate, report or take it to the next level. If the claims don't bear any merit, we're done. I mean, we're just done. And then we can close that chapter and we can move on after a full and fair hearing. I mean, let's have a trial, in a sense. I mean, let's look at the evidence at the second meeting in March. If there's credibility, we'll bring in the people that need to be brought in to look at it, the next people in the chain. And if there's not, then we're done. We can move on. And not have to listen to it about it anymore.
Okay. And you can ask me or someone at the village for, there are emails that have come from the State Historic Society, Joe DeRose, and Jim Dreger at the State Historic Society, obviously defending themselves against these allegations. There are emails from Legacy that addressing the specific concerns. But do you want those made available to the board for that second meeting in March?
Yeah, I think we should. That'll give Mr. O'Rourke plenty of time to get us what he's got. And I think that we should have a small binder put together by the clerk that would have the communiques from the State Historical Society or Legacy or whatever else, whoever else has weighed in on this particular issue.
Does it have to be a small binder? There are lots of emails going back between
large
Mr.
binder.
O'Rourke and me and the State Historic Society, the attorney and the consultant, Legacy, the consultant.
Well, the ones that have some meat and substance to them. I mean, if they're generalized allegations, I don't want to see them. I mean, I want to see the specifics. I know that'll make Debbie's job a little harder to you know. But if it's got some meat to the bones and there's some specific factual allegations, yeah, let's see that. I mean, if it just says you're illegal and this shall be redone, I don't want to see it. I mean, I want to see the specifics that underlie those generalized statements. And then we can weigh and evaluate it at the second meeting in March.
Okay. I'd like to open it up to Mr. O'Rourke if he'd like to make some comments. Or to anyone else who'd like to speak.
Thank you. First of all, I stand by what everything I've said. I've never used the word fraud. I've been very careful of that. Because, and I don't accuse people, I complain about organizations. I've complained about the state organization, and it is the State Historic Preservation Office that tampered with this survey of Sunset Park. They did not follow the federal guidelines for historic districts. Very simple. There's 16 houses there. On day one, I asked the committee to look at those 16 houses. I provided pristine data on the architectural integrity of 5,000 houses and commercial buildings at the beginning of the survey to the contractor. That pristine data came from the village tax assessor. And the State Historic Society tampered with the survey and altered the federal guidelines so that they could have Sunset Circle included as a historic district to the detriment of other areas. So what I'm telling you right now, I said on day one, and I've said it every month for the past 2 years at the meetings. The village administrator, when I complained about rights to open meetings, made me look like a bad person for requesting that the meetings be recorded because the minutes did not accurately reflect what was being said in those meetings, and those minutes were supposed to go to the state. So I then asked that the village administrator record all the meetings. And that became an issue of contention, too. So the fact of the matter is that I did not accuse people of fraud. I accused the State Historic Preservation Office of tampering with our survey and altering the federal guidelines for what it means to be a historic district. There were 16 homes, and that altering has now had an adverse impact on the State Highway 57 project that is going to cost $10 million to redo and affect our village for the next 50 years. So I've asked, I don't need to wait 2 weeks. I've told you what I have, and I use, because my records don't matter, I use the open records request, and I've told Steve exactly what to look at through the open records request. There's something called field notes that belong to the village that are missing, and that there's accounting irregularities. So there's a lot there, and the state has signed off on it, and it's the state's responsibility to protect us and to protect the National Park Service. Thank you.
In Mr. O'Rourke's defense, I'm not absolutely certain that he used the word fraud in any of his emails. He might have. I don't know. But did use the words, just like he did now, tampering, and that they ignored or changed federal rules. So I may have inserted the word fraud to encompass both of those concepts. Now that we're having the discussion, is that specific enough?
Or are you still wanting Mr. O'Rourke to compile some evidence? I guess I'm talking to you, Trustee Gast, that you said you'd like some specifics and some specific evidence, and Mr. O'Rourke just said, I just gave it to you. Does that suffice for you?
Not for me. I mean, I want to know what guidelines they violated. I want to know, and specifically, what ways they tampered with the study, and specifically, you know, how they violated or ignored. I mean, I want to see the regulations. I want to see specifically what did they do to tamper with it. I mean, that's what I'm looking for. I mean, I want to compare the regulations. I want to know what they're supposed to do. I want to know what they did. And I want to know where the divergence is and where the tampering is.
There's something called field notes, which, as a surveyor, the contractor was supposed to take field notes. Now, they take field notes on computers now, and what they've given me as their field notes were simple notations on a map, and they're saying that those are field notes. Those notations, along with a narrative that was provided me by one of the workers, indicate that there was heavy guidance by the state on what to do at Sunset Park. Sunset Park itself, there are notations on the map that indicate that it should have been included in the historic district, but it was deleted from the historic district for some reason. So that's just one of the things. And then additional homes, which were built in the 70s and 80s, were then added to the Sunset Park Historic District so that the homes around Mr. Lombardi's house would then constitute a historic district, because Mr. Lombardi's house won't qualify for the National Register for another 2 years because it needs to be 50 years since the event that made him historic ceased to exist. So that's the nature of that. In a nutshell, there's 16 houses, there's two or three records that you have to look at, there's missing field notes, which are required by the Planning Commission to operate to operate the Historic Preservation Commission as a planning tool. We're supposed to have the field notes and a record of all of the homes that they evaluated, and they didn't do that. I gave them very detailed note records on every single house in the village, and they didn't do their job. And that is where this is all coming from, is there's state and federal guidelines that are supposed to be followed, and those all got thrown out the door for whatever reason, for that day in October when the State Historic Office took our contractor through and ruined our survey. So it's on the notations from the map, and those notations are not adequate field notes.
Mr. O'Rourke, excuse me, I'm sorry, and you still have the floor. Okay, I just, in terms of a couple of the things that you said where I was writing the notes down, in terms of the field notes, do we know if those kind of field notes are, or the manner in which you're saying they were written down for us, or you know, not written down, is that the process that they follow these days in terms of other municipalities where they do their surveys? I don't know if they're being consistent or if it was inconsistent for LA. That'd be one of the questions, and then I had one other thing from something else you said.
Well, the notation,
that's maybe something we can check into.
Well,
looking at
the notations on the map, okay, the suspect, there's gaps in the numbering system. So mathematically, there was a numbering system that was used as they were driving the city. Those were written in one color pencil, and the problematic properties have a higher number and are written in red. So all you need to do is get a hold of the map, look for the red numbers, and then pull those vinyls, and that'll tell you where the problems are. The red numbers on Sunset Circle next to Mr. Lombardi's house. And it's not fair to drag Mr. Lombardi's name through the mud with this crummy survey. We have a great story to tell about Alloway. We have historic old Alloway. We have a wonderful story to tell about the Packers, and for the state to come through and try and grab some glory by running with the Packers story that just isn't ripe yet, that's where the sham is.
Do you have those records? I mean, you seem to have the map with the red numbers and all the records.
All these records are owned by the village. And
But if you have them all in one spot,
yes.
I mean, couldn't you provide what I've been asking for 2 years, the allegation, and then the regulation, what it is, what the rule is, what they were supposed to do, what they did, and then the packet. You're going to have to let me finish.
Okay.
And then a packet of supporting materials, these files that would support your allegation, just what Mr. Gasp was asking. If you have those in your possession, why would you not want to provide them to the...
I provided them, and...
Would you not want to provide them, in now that the entire board has an interest in this, I think, or Mr. Gass does, at least, why would you not want to provide that information to Mr. Gass?
I've told you exactly what it is that it is, what you're looking for, and then what I've asked for is for the village to contact the National Park Service. The National Park Service said, thank you, Mr. O'Rourke, we believe that what you're saying may be accurate. We would prefer that request come from the village board. I approached the board and asked you to contact the National Park Service when I brought it all to you, and we've been fighting tooth and nail for the last year and a half on this.
Did we have that correspondence from the National Park Service saying that you should...
That was by telephone. So I talked with them. They called me back. They said that this is a request that should come from the village board. I appeared before the village board. I asked for the village board to request a study be done on it, and it never went anywhere. I speak, and it never goes anywhere.
It has. We sent a letter to the National Park Service asking it to give us some guidance with regard to your specific allegations. And so if you had already had correspondence with them, we're waiting for them to give us some guidance.
I've spoken with them at the very beginning.
So I think we're going to...
We needed the village to evaluate what was in their files, what was missing. The only thing that really would have helped is that had the village read the contract that they signed and enforced the contract with regards to what documents were supposed to be submitted and how the billing was supposed to be done, that would have solved the problem on day one. But we ran into a real problem, and now with the new administration, I feel very comfortable with the new administration that they can get to the bottom of this.
So I'm going to conclude that do not want to share your evidence.
I'll give you everything I got.
Okay. Well, Mr. Gast has a request for specific allegations, what was supposed to be done, what actually was done, the disjunct between those two, and then supporting documentation that something was done. That's the request. And if you have it in your possession, it should be easy for you to produce very quickly. Okay. Anyone else would like to speak with regard to this issue? Ms. Copperwood, do you have anything to add?
A difficult time on the Historic Preservation Committee, and we have lost a couple of...
I'm sorry, can you...
It has been difficult at our meetings, and Jim has spoken at, I believe, every meeting, and we have lost a couple of members, and there are a lot of people that would be interested in being on the committee, but they've heard what's been happening, and we've been a few members short for a while.
Yeah. Everyone's at a boiling point. I can understand the frustration. Again, we do have a new administrator. We're all very confident in Brad. We have Trevor on board. I couldn't have more confidence in Trevor. And you're going to have a new president and maybe a new board member, I guess by definition, right? because Randy won't be here and I won't be here, so maybe this is a nice opportunity to sort of start afresh. But I'm telling you, you got to watch the rhetoric. The words that you use really do have an impact, and you can get lots of people putting up barriers if you don't use the right words. So I think we're all after the same thing, what's for the betterment of the village, and so maybe this represents us turning a corner. Trustee Harris.
I wanted to double check something that Mr. O'Rourke said when I was writing my notes, and because I just to confirm, because the two things I wrote down in terms of the field notes missing and then accounting records changed.
Okay. The accounting records. The state, the federal government has maximum allowable rates that contractors are allowed to charge, and the village is responsible for keeping track of those hours. The actual hours are very, the mileage and hours are regulated by the federal government, and there is no record of the days and hours that the contractor actually worked. So I met with the previous administration, and we went through this, and the records that were in their files were insufficient for determining when people were doing what mileage was out there. So the federal government, the National Park Service, has very carefully worded guidelines on how the billing is supposed to be done, and we didn't supervise it correctly.
Mr. O'Rourke, have you talked with our new administrator about this entire issue and about
your... I've tried not to.
Why? If you're confident in our new administrator that he can solve the problem, why haven't you brought the problem to him?
This is an executive issue, and this Brad is in operationals, and I was trying not to bring in this mess that I have with you into that relationship.
Oh, it's about a relationship. Okay. He's the guy to go to.
Okay.
He's the operations guy. When you ask me for open records requests, and I've told you this 100 times in our emails, what do? I send it to the clerk. And you keep sending it to me. The administrator is the guy to look into this as to whether or not this was taken care of. He's involved. He oversees all the contracts and the operations of the village. And so the operations of this particular project weren't done correctly. If it's a problem you have about our operations and whether we oversaw a project properly, that's the guy to see. I'm puzzled as to why you haven't if you had so much confidence in him.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I didn't have that permission before, but thank you very much.
Permission?
Permission now from you to bring this up to Brad. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Trustee Dennis.
There are an awful lot of flies on this pile, and I don't want to hear any of the past pile of stuff that's there. I want a clear and concise statement of what's wrong, why it's wrong, and what needs to be corrected. I don't want he says, she says, they said, it should be, if it's not. If it's not reduced to writing, if it's not reduced to paper, if it's not an intellectual-based item on which I can take in information and make a decision, then it is irrelevant. It has nothing but hearsay behind it. It therefore needs to be presented to us in a short, concise form of what the problem is and how we can deal with it, if in fact it is a problem. If it is only accusations back and forth, and if it is the incorrect, inappropriate use of semantics, then that is an issue for someone else, not for us. And I guess I am restating what Trustee Gast has said, and I just think there's a lot of time been wasted on all this. And I'm not going to put time into it because at this point, I don't see the value behind it. I cannot see the value behind any of this without proper documentation. And it should not proceed without it. If it is not presented to us in a timely fashion, then it should be set aside and we'll move on.
I mean, the overall issue is extremely, and I know this isn't what you're saying, is extremely important. I mean, whether it's an area or individual houses or on the registry, as Mr. Fuller pointed out, there are definite benefits of having historic neighborhoods and historic properties. So I know that's something you're saying, but what you're saying is...
I have no issues with that whatsoever.
Right. Trustee Raster.
I agree with everything that's been said. I do think what bothers me is the amount of time spent over the last 2 years on the issue and the cost to the village. When Mr. O'Rourke says that someone's tampered with the survey, even though you don't use the word fraud, it's suggesting that, and it's suggesting actually criminal activity as far as I would guess. And saying they didn't follow the federal guidelines, once again, if we can see what the federal guidelines are, how they didn't meet those federal guidelines, what they did to tamper with the survey, Mr. O'Rourke said that the state provided there was heavy guidance by the state to change the field notes. I'd like to see what that is.
Change the district.
Okay. So I'd like to see, I'm assuming that's in written form. They wrote a letter saying, ignore what was done, what we're supposed to do, but do this. And so if that, in fact, exists, I'd like to see that. So
they are in comments from an employee that documents the events of that day and what he was told to do.
I think Mr. O'Rourke can appreciate, like Trustee Dennis said, it's hearsay. We surely can't go to the National Park Service and say, based on what one of our residents has, right as he may be or wrong as he may be, without proof, we can't go forward. And I ask you, instead of having seven people go tear through documents and cost the village more money, because every time a request comes to one of us, a request goes to Debbie. And so Debbie gets to 1 times 7, gets to process something. She's got a lot of more important things to do. So if we can consolidate the effort.
No. Mr. O'Rourke, you did not have the floor, sir.
If we can consolidate the effort, get the information together, I don't think there's anyone on this board who wouldn't want to step forward if something was done wrong. But I'll speak for myself.
Would you like to speak, Mr. O'Rourke?
That is why I use Steve as my point man, and I don't. Steve can distribute my communications as he sees fit.
But he can't.
That's why I spoke strictly with Steve, because he was, I believe, the chief executive officer for the village. And he's told me that he isn't, and the village doesn't have a chief executive officer. Once he told me that, that's why I sent you all the following email.
But once again, it's to be directed to Debbie. President Vandenhoven couldn't send all of us an email to discuss that, because that breaks open meetings laws. So if you can facilitate the information the right way, and if it's, like Mr. Dennis said, clear and concise and factual, I think we take a look at it.
And you'll submit it to the National Park Service.
I don't know what we'll do. We'll surely consider it. I did see somewhere in my research that anyone, any person or governmental entity can make an appeal to the National Park Service. So you could, as a citizen, file an appeal. And I am a little surprised that after 2 years of frustration on your part, you haven't done that. But that's not for me to say, even though I said it.
Any further discussion on the related topic of the intensive survey? And we still have to wrap up discussion on the raise ordinance here. Any further discussion on the raise ordinance? Trevor, thank you so much. And Barb, thank you so much for working on the ordinance and for the presentation. I think it was really important for all of us to get at least some similar foundation to one another. And in a way where you didn't have to present it separately to seven different people. Trustee Harris, did you have something?
Yes, thanks. I think it was something Trustee Guest said earlier in terms of what we're voting on tonight doesn't have anything, maybe I didn't hear it correctly, that's what I'm asking, anything to do with creating historical districts or I've lost the wording now, but we're looking at the raising, but there seems to also be wording in here about creating historical areas. I can't think of the wording. So I just want to make sure.
We're amending 13.09 and repealing and recreating Chapter 424. And in Chapter 424, there is verbiage about creating historic districts. And
right. That's so, what I want to make sure.
Trustee Gast, I don't think, is right in that. That's what you're saying.
That,
right?
I think,
Trustee Gast, is your.
That's what we do, admit that I'm wrong. That's not going to happen.
I wouldn't even.
I was looking, when I spoke before, I was looking at the raised portion of it. And
the other portion already exists anyway.
So we're not making any changes to it, but it is part of what we're voting on. I didn't know.
But the ordinance says that we're amending Section 13.09.
Yeah.
Involving raising of buildings, and we are repealing and recreating Chapter 424 that involves and definitions and procedures for designation. And
was a large amount just reformatting?
Yes.
Just reorganization.
Right.
Yeah, and to the extent that it talks about creation of historic districts or designations, I mean, it provides the procedures for it, but it doesn't condone one way or the other whether something's already been, designated, whether it's right or it's wrong. I mean, it just tells you how you get there procedurally.
Right.
But this doesn't say that the intensive survey is correct or it's incorrect. I mean, that's a whole different.
Right. But I think Mr. O'Rourke's point, and I agree with him, is that the intensive survey provides the larger context in which decisions like this sort of fit. But I don't think we need to postpone the decision on this because of any questions we have about the intensive survey. They're related. They're definitely related. This kind of sits within a larger context.
If you left this whole section.
Just move. Any further discussion? All in favor? Or is there a motion on the floor, actually? Trustee Rafter.
Genrick, actually.
Trustee Rafter, would you like to make a motion?
Go ahead.
No, I'd like Trustee Genrick, too.
Trustee Genrick makes a motion.
I would move that we adopt Ordinance 2015-02, raising of buildings, as indicated on our agenda here. Move to approve.
Trustee Rafter.
I'll second.
Discussion. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Item 7, action regarding the 6-month review for the administrator. Brad's been waiting on pins and needles for this. We had a closed session last time to talk about the new administrator's performance during his first 6 months on the job, but what we didn't do after we came out of that closed session is actually to vote as to whether he should continue in the position or not. And, I don't know if we still have probationary status. Is that, I think we got away from that some years ago. But, so I need a motion tonight to continue to employ the village administrator, and I will actually make that motion. Is there a second? Seeing no second, the motion passes. Trustee Gass.
I'll second.
Discussion, we can't discuss too much what happened in closed session. I did get a chance to sort of debrief Brad on the strengths and weaknesses that were mentioned, and I think that you're going to probably get a unanimous decision to go forward, and we really appreciate the enthusiasm and the effort and the talent that you're bringing to the position.
And we're assuming he's willing to continue?
No, I don't care about that. Further discussion.
Do we all get autographed copies of the neighbor magazines?
Oh, I forgot to bring mine in.
Don't you have a friend to put on that wall?
I thought you were talking about the bridge. The bridge was very nice.
Well, both. Yeah.
I think it should be noted also from Mr. Froman's presentation the public support and positive impact, even to this point in time, that the current administrator has had on the review that was put out there and had requested of the citizens of Alloway and their positive feedback in regards to Brad and what he has done to this point.
All right, so the Brad Love Fest might be done soon. Here we go. You ready to vote? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Congratulations, Brad, and thanks. Item number 8, action regarding the Public Works Committee minutes from February 12th, the annual stormwater report for 2014. Do you want to hear anything from Mr. Burnt with regard to this before I entertain a motion? I got sort of a tentative nod from Trustee Harris that he would, but
yes.
Is there a motion with regard to this item? Do you want to move forward?
Since we have, I would like to hear.
Okay, unless there are objections, we'll suspend the rules and hear from Mr. Burke before entertaining a motion.
The item A, annual stormwater report for 2014. Each year we have to file report with the Department of Natural Resources, which is sort of like a status report on our stormwater program, basically what happened in the previous reporting year. The first page of this report is a 5-point summary of just the key things that have happened. In one sense, this was a somewhat non-eventful 2014, if you will. We're kind of in the middle of our program where there may be things coming up in the future, but right now we're pretty much caught up current and there's no major activities going on. But these five items, item one was we completed the Heritage Hill stormwater treatment project. This year you will see the prairie in blue. It is completed, accepted, final payment is in progress, and that's completed. Item two, ultimately we're going to have to meet the Fox River, East River, total mass daily load discharge limitations some years out in the future. At this point, we're above a 40% removal of suspended solids with our overall program. The last item on this agenda is we'll be looking at, item five, we'll be looking at kind of what the future goals and objectives will be in a very short form type summary. And then we'll talk about where we are today versus where we need to be in 10 to 14 years. But we're doing very well from where we are today. We've got a very good start on where we need to be way out in the future. Because of item three, Riverside Drive project, there will be two stormwater treatment systems put in as part of that project. They will be funded by the state as part of the project. That will help us. That will be the next step in meeting the long-term goals of our stormwater program, the ultimate requirements that we have to meet with the Fox River TMPO. The plus on this is that the state will fund construction of those stormwater treatment systems. So that does save us some money long term because they are expensive treatment systems and they'll be part of the project and we benefit. Item four, there's a couple of new things that are coming into play in the stormwater program. Reporting winter snow and ice management is one, and we provided some data on that. And we believe that what it's going to lead to at some point in time is communities are going to have to manage their use of road salt because of the concerns of salt impacts on receiving waters. And we know that in the wastewater treatment facilities already, that's becoming a factor. So down the road, there will be some impact. We, as a community, are doing very well in managing our road salt. We are way below the typical standards that people have to meet So we're doing very well in that regard, but that is something that's new.
Is that because of that brine that we use?
That is part of it, but the basic thing is anything that we can do to reduce the number of tons of salt that we use, that's what we need to do. And when I started here, we were using up in the neighborhood of 1,200 tons per year of road salt, and we're down in the range of 500 tons per year that we're using now.
Well, what have we done besides the brine, too?
Reduce the usage. Every year we've reduced the usage. We've gone to, instead of salting entire roads, salt the key intersections.
Oh, okay.
And salt midpoints.
And the stop signs.
On a long street, for example, drop salt maybe in three spots.
Okay.
And that lets the salt be traveled by the vehicles, but it reduces the usage. We don't have to put as much down. And the salt brine, the liquid brine, helps a lot. It reduces the amount of dry road salt that we use. So we're still using salt, but we've cut the use in half over the last 8-9 years. That's a big impact. Mm-hmm. If you look at Alloway Avenue, you'll see if it's white. That's a county road. And the county and the state highways operate under different criteria than we do on residential streets. So we can get by with less salt, but they may not be able to because of state criteria for bare pavement and winter storm events.
And Rick, we've seen no change in traffic accidents as a result of us saving on salt.
No, I think so.
Perfect. Thank you.
So that's an upcoming thing. The other one is we'll have to have more intensive management program of our own village facilities for pollution prevention. And that's something we'll be working on this year. In 2016, we have to begin reporting that. We already have the plans. It's just to get the training and the documentation in place. Because it was done as part of our most recent stormwater management plan. And then item 5, what's upcoming, work that we need to be doing in the short term, a little bit of work on our ordinances because a couple of the regulations changed. So in the next 18 months, we need to update our stormwater ordinances. And I mentioned we're going to do a little mini plan update on Fox River TMDL. And what we're going to have to do in the next 5, 10, and 15 years to kind of meet the ultimate goals of the Fox River TMDL. And the other thing that we need to do that I didn't mention here is we were issued our new discharge permit about 6 months ago. By the end of year 4, this mini plan that I talked about here, that will form the basis for a report that we need to send to the Department of Natural Resources, which will be how we intend to meet the TMDL within that 15-year period. So we will have to do an update of some sort and a report to the DNR on what our plan will look like and our own milestones and things that we will set for ourselves so that ultimately, when we need to, we'll be meeting the treatment requirements or the discharge requirements on the Fox and East Rivers. So that's where some of the other things like the phosphorus trading, you may have read about on the Fox River, and some of the upstream treatment where you buy capacity upstream from farmers, for example, might come into play. I don't think we will get into that, but that is part of what we have to look at in the plan. And that plan will be due in about 3 years. So at this point, this is our annual report. You can accept it and place it on file. And this is not like the compliance maintenance annual report for the sanitary sewer system that has a resolution you have to pass. You don't have a resolution you have to pass for this. You're basically accepting it to place on file and authorizing it to be submitted to the DNR. That's basically what it is.
Thank you, Craig. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Harris?
I move to accept on file.
And do we need to send this to the state, you said?
I'm assuming that's part of your motion. Send it to the state, yes.
Okay.
Is there a second? Trustee Dart, seconds. Further discussion? Trustee Rafter?
Craig, I just have one question. Looking at the spreadsheet, the revenue and expense versus budget, the first line item is stormwater management GR. Year-to-date actual is $182,000, and our budget was $2,500.
$25,000?
Yeah, $2,500 versus $182,000. The first page of the spreadsheet.
Yeah, what that is we had carried stormwater grants in our budget planning for the last couple of years. With the delay in the Heritage Hill project extending out at least 18 months longer than we thought it would, and the closure to the Kiwanis and Huffman Road projects, it took a long time for the final grant payments to come in. So this year we collected basically, or 2014, we collected the balance of the grant money that we were due from those projects. So they were actually listed in the previous couple of years, and they went uncollected. Here's where we picked them up, and that's why it looks like such a large number in here. We had originally thought we'd only have about $2,500 in residual grants.
Okay.
It spilled over from 2013 to 2014. That's what happened.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Yes, let's do that. Ms. Bainan's suggestion was to accept the minutes from the Public Works Committee as well and place those on file. Is that?
I also wish to add that to the motion, yes.
And Trustee Dart?
Yes.
Sounds like a good idea. Further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The EO lockdown. This is with regard to item 9, the 2014 CSEC activity report.
I apologize for not getting to teach this to you earlier. I always have good intentions of getting it done well before the meeting, and when it comes to finding the information that I can't look up myself, I always run into something. So, for those of you that haven't seen this report from me before, it's been the same template the last few years I've been using. The information in the report regarding the call volume itself is what I can look up through our computer-assisted dispatch system, which is what we have in our cars each time there's an incident that we respond to or initiate ourselves. I have the ability to look that up, the same information online, which I spend time in the office doing there. It's quite accurate. The one exception I tell people about is, for example, if I do a traffic stop, if I see somebody in the village, a couple weeks ago, for example, I followed somebody. They got on the 172 before I could catch up to them, and I wasn't about to stop them in the middle of the bridge, so I actually stopped them. We ended up in the PetSmart parking lot before I actually stopped them. In that case, you know, I did issue a citation, still went to the village of Valley. So when I search these calls, I do it specifically within the borders of the village, so that call may not be included in those numbers. So stuff like that does happen as far as traffic stops. But overall, the numbers are pretty accurate. You'll see from the last few years, I've been just going with 3 years, we've stayed within total calls within about 500 over the last 3 years, so it's been very consistent. As far as types of calls the last couple of years, what I've noticed is we've done quite well as far as the stuff like property crimes, such as vandalism or thefts, burglaries, stuff that you know, you try to control with patrol activities, stuff like, or things like that. What I do see is a lot of calls that come in as burglaries. They're not true, random, someone broke into my house and stole my stuff. Typically, it's, oh, I'm missing this, and I think, you know, someone, a friend of a friend who was here the other night, you know, took it, stuff like that. So it's not the true random, someone was casing the area, looking to go break in houses. We do get that more often with thefts from vehicles, but we've been very fortunate where we haven't seen a lot of it this last year. Typically in summer, we usually see a few strings, which happened. But I know, I think in 2012, in that summer, I remember being particularly bad. The last couple of years haven't been so bad. And what we do see is typically it's the people going, walking up and down the street at night, checking car doors. If it's open, they take a quick look in to see if there's anything they want. So it's, we always emphasize to residents to lock their doors and take their valuables out of the vehicles. Most of the time, it's very preventable. You'll see some numbers about the cases that get assigned to our investigative division. I don't know exactly who gets the reports from investigative. I think they send me the same information that either the board gets or maybe Brad. I don't know for sure. But anytime one of our officers does an incident report, it ends up at the investigative division for review. If there's information that the officer wasn't able to follow up with, that an investigator can follow up with and try to close that case, they'll do that. If there's no information available that they can follow up with, it might just get closed unless something else comes up about it. You'll see a breakdown of the calls. In the village, again, this is the searches I do within the limits of the village. Through the municipal court here, there was 1,175 ordinance or traffic citations issued by officers. That number does not include any ordinances that were issued by Mark Roberts or the building inspector. I'm not sure if the building inspector really issues many, but I know Mark does on occasion. I outlined some of the activities that I'm involved in that have been ongoing, such as neighborhood watch stuff, neighborhood associations. As far as those go, I continue to get some phone calls about neighborhood watch. My hopes would be that once weather warms up, people want to come outside more. We'll start getting more interest in some meetings. But even as of a couple days ago, I got another email from somebody that was interested. So we're working on getting materials for them and keeping in touch with them so we can get meetings together. Trevor and I have also been sending out mailings occasionally and picking out neighborhoods, both neighborhood associations. I know I've gotten one or two responses. I don't remember, Trevor, did you get a call too?
Yes.
So we've had some responses to that, and I'm kind of hoping the same thing. Once people get out of their houses and start talking to their neighbors more, we can get the ball rolling.
It won't be this week.
Probably not, yeah. We get to the park, which is a big long list of arrests. Those are arrest entries out of our reporting system, which is called ProPhoenix. Anytime we arrest somebody, we do what's called an arrest entry that gets attached with that person's name and gets attached to the report, and it's basically the system's way of keeping records. So you'll notice in there that there's some simple traffic crimes that are in the descriptions. What those are is offenses that are typically attached to an OWI offense. That's why they show up in this report. But if I stop somebody just for speeding and I give them a speeding ticket, it's not going to be in there. But because it was associated with an OWI, that's why it's there. Towards the end, I just highlighted a few incidents that kind of jumped out in my mind from last year. In February, there was a stabbing at St. Mikey's Pub. It was turned out that the suspect and the person knew each other, alcohol involved, they're having an argument. The suspect was at the hospital with the person when officers were called, so it wasn't exactly a random bar fight, so to speak. It's very rare that we get a call for disturbance at any of the bars or restaurants in alley, so we do pretty well on that end. In March, Deputy Shield, another deputy responded to Garland Street. This is a perfect case of a citizen who happened to be up in the wee hours of the morning, saw four individuals that were younger walking down the street checking car doors. Officers were able to get to the area, stop those individuals. At least two of them admitted that, yes, we were looking at into cars. They were cited for prowling, and I think others were issued citations for curfew violations as well. So when it comes to those random acts of what we see with people checking car doors, that was a good one to see happen. In July, there was a stabbing in Green Bay, which the suspect, they came up with an address on East River Drive. They had deputies go check the address. They weren't able to find the person immediately. Later on that morning, Deputy Shield just happened to see a person matching that description over here on St. Joseph Street. When he was getting turned around to go stop the person ran. So there was a sort of short pursuit, but they ended up catching him. So that was a good catch by Deputy Shield. July, there was a medical call. Deputy Muslva and I responded to, which was a baby that was unresponsive just after being born at home. Muslva happened to be very close by, got on scene immediately, well, I shouldn't say immediately, but probably within a minute, started doing CPR on the baby. I got there a little bit after him. We tried using the defibrillators that we carry in our cars with pediatric pads. It didn't do a shock at that point. Rescue personnel arrived a little bit later. From what we heard back from rescue is that by the time they got to the hospital, the baby was doing pretty well. Spent some time in the hospital, but apparently made a full recovery. So that was a pretty big deal, I guess.
Well done, Dr. Lopnow.
Well, I didn't do a whole lot. Actually, Deputy Muslva is doing most of the work by doing compressions. He did receive a life-saving award last week, since he was the one mostly hands-on there.
Someone, our congratulations and appreciation.
Yeah. In December, we had a very strange robbery attempt at CBS. Myself and Deputy Vogel and other deputies responded to a strange phone call. It seemed like almost a anonymous tip that someone called, didn't give much information, just said, hey, that place is getting robbed. We arrived on scene. People were going in and out like normal. Jason and I approached the front door. We could see the manager walking up like nothing was going on. So we walk in. We look over. The clerk's standing there. Nothing's going on. There was a guy I had seen at the intersection of Webster and Alloway Avenue maybe 5 minutes earlier that kind of caught my eye standing there. And the clerk says, he said he has a gun. So we grabbed him, take him into custody. There was no gun. But after we talked to him, looked at the surveillance video, it was obvious that he was making a motion under his coat like he had a gun and made some weird statements, so he was arrested for robbery. Otherwise, you know, take the time, look through this. If you have any specific questions, please do ask me, and feel free to contact me. Stuff that wasn't in here that kind of came to mind, as far as our sex offender ordinance. I did cite one person. It was Mr. Munion, who lived on Boker Street. We gave him so many opportunities to move on, find a different place. For whatever reason, he couldn't do it. After long discussions with Dennis Duffy, we went ahead and issued a citation. The interesting part of what it was, when I knocked on his door to give him the citation, he opened the door, and he and his wife were using marijuana at the time. So they got more citations for that as well, and they were evicted shortly after. Since we started doing the notifications and have our new ordinance in place, I think we've had one offender that moved into the village, and that individual was a local individual that I know we have dealt with numerous times in the past. Growing up, he's a younger guy, moved in with his parents, so he was within the exceptions that are aligned in the ordinance itself. We have done the notifications since last summer. We've gotten a couple calls from concerned residents. Nothing too bad. When this last individual, the younger guy that moved back in with his parents, moved in, I had one nasty voicemail. She didn't ask me to call back or leave a number for me, so I didn't. But it was obviously that she wasn't aware of the ongoing conversation that we had all last year about sex offenders. So it was the same complaints and concerns that we heard constantly. As far as alleyway officers for last year and this year, three out of the five that are assigned to work the regular patrol shifts return to alleyway. So I think we have a good mix of veterans with experience and a couple of younger guys that are fairly new that are, you know, you're eager to get out there and work too. So I think overall we're doing very well. So I don't want to take up too much time here, but if anybody has any quick questions.
One quick question. Of 7,321 calls in 2014, that's 20 per day.
That's pretty normal.
That seems like, really?
One thing you can look at is that number includes traffic stops.
Oh, okay.
So
1,000 traffic stops.
Yeah, just about every shift.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say every shift, but there's a good chance on any given shift an officer's going to make at least one stop.
Okay.
So the numbers add up pretty quickly.
Right.
There are some calls. I think I mentioned this last year. We've kind of changed our response to medical calls, especially since Green Bay's taken over. In years past, we used to respond to every medical call. We don't do that anymore. You know, they have the manpower to deal with it. We're not equipped to deal with a lot of things. So unless it's something
critical.
Except for
babies, apparently.
Yeah. And if it's something critical, like, I guess, heart attack, person down, unconscious, you know, not breathing, unresponsive, that kind of thing, then we'll get the call and respond as first responders. But a lot of the rescue calls go without police response nowadays. Yes?
Just a quick question. Battery by prisoners. Is that...
That's calls generated from the prison. Our patrol officers generally don't deal with that. There's an investigator that's assigned to take those types of complaints from the prison. Occasionally, we do respond there. It doesn't happen very often. We don't actually go in. Usually, if it's something to do with a visitor, every once in a while, someone shows up with drugs in their pocket, something just goofy like that, and get caught. Then they'll call a patrol officer over there. If it's an inmate issue, an investigator takes care of it. Yes?
What's the difference between just calls within the village and calls with assigned deputies?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have explained that. What I can do in the CAD system when I do the search, I use the parameters of, you know, the city limits or the village limits, and then the difference between the overall number, like for 2014, the 7321, that's every officer that took a call or made a traffic stop in the village. So that's
like the example you gave before, where if you stop someone in Bellevue, that wouldn't be counted here, but it would be counted in Bellevue as a stop, but not by their officer, by our officer.
So the 5800 number is when I select any officer that was assigned to work alleyway for a shift in the computer system, and then I can do it for the year, and that's where that number comes from. So the other,
couple thousand
there, I know a lot of it could be the Brown County traffic team. They do a lot of traffic up on Highway 172, so I don't know who gets the reports these days or who doesn't get the daily reports, but you might see a lot of traffic stops at like 172 in Libel or 172 in East River. That's the Brown County traffic team normally, not an alley assigned officer.
I thought it was maybe a rescue squad thing. You said you wouldn't join in. It was still a call.
Okay. There's also times if the alley officer's tied up on one call and there's another call that can't wait, they'll send a county officer in. So that's where the second number, the 1500 number, comes from. That's just the alley assigned officers.
Thank you.
Like I said, anything comes up, please don't hesitate to give me a call.
Thank you. Any further questions? Is there a motion to adjourn? Trustee Genrich, second. Trustee Dennis, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? We're adjourned. Thank you.